Welcome to the Gravity Well podcast. I am your host, Jenny Aramey. Here you break down heavy ideas with me to understand their complexities and connections. Our mission is to work through dilemmas together in conversation and process. I acknowledge that I live on the traditional territory of Treaty 7 and Métis Districts 5 and 6. The treaties and self-governance agreements established by Indigenous peoples were created to honour the laws of the land, maintain balance with nature by giving back, and uphold reciprocal relationships. This knowledge and intention are what guide the Gravity Well conversation. I ask for genuine dialogue, real hearts, and openness to different perspectives. This is your invitation to find common ground with me. This podcast is dedicated to the natural world, our children, nieces, nephews, grandchildren, and all future generations. The Gravity Well is on YouTube and streaming wherever you get your podcasts. Join us at thegravitywell.net. Okay, we are down in the Crow's Nest Pass. No, we are in Beaver Mines, just south of the Crow's Nest Pass. I'll let you explain it in a minute here. So we're at Mike Judd's place, here with Alan Garbutt and Colin Smith. Colin and I came down from Calgary, very excited for this conversation, for two long-standing fighters for the Eastern Slopes. Thank you for all the work you guys have done. So why are we here? We're here to talk about protection and restoration of the Eastern Slopes, the place where we live. So let's start with some introductions. I think you know enough about me, but I'll just a little for you just in case. So I'm a geophysicist. I worked in development. You know, we were just talking offline about frack development and stuff, and I was involved in all of that and ignorant for a long time, and then became aware in about 2014 when oil prices fell out is when I first started to pay attention to liabilities of the impact we were having, the sites that we were leaving, a bunch of water trying to get rid of it. And realizing this was a growing issue and not being maintained or not being looked after at the same pace that's required. Anyway, so that's my background and how I came into this knowledge and awareness of this issue. So why don't you start, please, Mike? Can you introduce yourself and give us a bit of your background as well, please?
Yeah, well, my name is Mike Judd. I live here on the Eastern Slopes, just west of Pincher Creek, near a little hamlet of Beaver Mines. And I live on the land that my mom and dad bought in 1946. It's mostly forested land with the little bits of open meadow, and was and has been wonderful elk range, and it's grizzly bear. I have grizzly bear den on my land, and another one that I know of close by. So this is very important landscape. If you get up on the hills here and look around, you can see the entire front of the Rocky Mountains and the beauty of it. And also what you're bound to become aware of is the kind of industrial intrusions that are starting to happen on it.
Right, yes. Thank you so much, I appreciate that. And you are the head of
Timberwolf.
Yeah, I wouldn't call myself the head, but I'm one of the members of Timberwolf Wilderness Society. And what our society is about is trying to get protection for the Eastern Slopes in the form of legislation, and to get beyond land use plans and other policies that are not working for us.
And I'd be remiss not to ask you to give us a little bit of info about how you protected the castle. So we're in the castle watershed right now, is that right?
That's correct. We're in the castle watershed. And I would say that over the course of four decades, starting 1970s, a group of us started talking about getting protection for the castle, and have been at it until 2013, I think it is, when it was officially designated as a wildland park and a provincial park. I think it's something that Albertans should be really proud of, the fact that we finally managed to acknowledge that wilderness is important, and that we're going to have a showcase example of it now in the future.
It's amazing. My husband was a forest firefighter and spent a lot of time in the castle.
Oh, really?
I was really stoked when he was actually on the the Crow's Nest Pass fire in 20...
Lost Creek.
In the Lost Creek fire?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's right. That was his last season.
Well, I could stand on that hill up there and watch those water bombers come over, and they weren't more than 50 yards above us.
Amazing. Yeah, he was on that fire for over 30 days. It was probably his biggest fire that he was involved in. But yeah, was super grateful when the castle was protected, so thank you for your work.
Well, I'm only one of many people that worked on that project.
Yeah. Well, thank you for your work. Alan, that leads to you, please. Can you give us a bit of your background in this fight for protection of the Eastern Slopes and what you're doing today?
Well, I was raised in Calgary, but a much smaller Calgary. The number three bus turned around at the end of my schoolyard. Mm-hmm. Dad took us fishing in the Old Man, Castle, Livingston area starting in about 1960. I've been in and out of that ever since, which I guess makes me really old. Got an undergrad degree in Edmonton in wildlife biology, went down east for some graduate degrees, came back with a PhD, worked in wildlife and consulting in Edmonton for a few years, decided I couldn't sell out any longer and went back to med school. Became a rural family doc, did my last year of training in Fernie and then moved to Crow's Nest Pass. Spent 26 years there. We've been living out on the Porcupines for 25 years now. I've been retired for 5. I started working with Livingston landowners more than a couple of decades ago when there was plans for high intensity drilling on our land, and then Alta Link for some reason thought that the easiest way to build a power line was over the roughest piece of country around. We fought, we won. I retired, thought I'd offer my help to the landowners. I knew about the coal mine. I had followed it and had actually read the EIA, for which I must be commended and called stupid. Realized that they didn't know what the H they were doing. It was a horrible one. I used to write these things. I used to mark them on undergrads. Any undergrad who turned that in, I'd have just failed, sent them back. I started reading it at number 8. If I had been that bad at the end of number 4 when I was working, I'd have been fired. They went to number 12, and then they got fired.
Wow.
But I did a bunch of work on the health impacts of coal for the landowners. We all went away. I thought I was going to get to go back to being a apprentice rancher. My neighbors tell me that's a 30-year job, so I guess I'm going to have to work hard to graduate. And we just keep running into them.
Yeah.
The East Slopes are absolutely vital. For the folks who don't know them, essentially they're the lumpy ground between the prairies or parklands and the mountains. In southern Alberta, they're maybe 20 kilometers wide. In northern Alberta, they're hundreds of kilometers wide. But those mountains provide the water that feeds the prairies. If we screw up the water, everybody from Manitoba west is in trouble. Cor Blund has said this before. This is not a right-left. This is a right-wrong.
Right.
And they're wrong.
And we can't undo it, right? If we make this mistake.
This is a one shot.
Yes.
If you destroy the water yield to the prairies, there is no way to go back and magically recreate the sponge that these slopes are. If you don't have the sponge, you don't have the water. Calgary, Edmonton, Red Deer, Lethbridge, Regina, Saskatoon, they're all toast.
Agreed. Yeah, thank you. Thank you guys both so much for all of your work. Colin and I are late to this game, but we are happy to be here working with you guys. It's a joy to be working with such tremendous people that are knowledgeable and willing to put your retirements towards helping this province stay together. So thank you. Colin, do you mind reintroducing yourself? Colin's been on the show a few times, at least probably 4 or 5 now that I think about it. Thank you for all your help here. But
yeah, I think the introduction changes a little bit every time because things are evolving. But
Yeah, I was born in Lethbridge. My father's family has been here for a few generations, and my mom was a new immigrant from North Yorkshire, England. But farming and land connected roots, and I've being born in the heart of Blackfoot Territory, I think, is something later in my life that is really, like, I feel a deep connection to this land in Southern Alberta that I've only started to, like, really explore and feel. Born in Lethbridge, but grew up in Calgary for most of my life. I've spent many days and summers and winters in the eastern slopes, and over those years, I'm seeing clear cut. I'm like, oh, okay, I understand there's some forestry, but then another clear cut, and then, like, wondering, when are these clear cuts going to stop? And yeah, that's what really got me involved in this. I think the clear cuts have been weighing on me for probably 15 to 20 years, but I didn't know what to do about it. And the pandemic allowed me to slow down and maybe reevaluate my priorities. I spent the pandemic living with my 96-year-old grandmother. That really instilled a different perspective on my life. And that's when I became really passionate about land and water protection, or being able to define it in that way. I've always tried to solve environmental problems through my work and my community work, but it's, I think, now is the time for greater organizing on this. So that's, I'm trying to play my humble role in organizing the community in which I have agency, which is, I would say, the Calgary community, but also understanding that Calgary and the Bow River watershed are nested in the South Saskatchewan watershed, which is Treaty 7 territory, the traditional territory of the Blackfoot Confederacy, as well as the Tsuut'ina and the Stoney Nakoda, who are also stewards of this land. And yeah, trying to find a new way to, or like a, at least for me, a way to approach these challenges and work towards these same goals of legislated protection of the eastern slopes. Alan explained the whole, like, this is our water, and we don't start taking a new, building a new eco-cultural relationship with it, instead of just seeing it as dollar signs to be extracted and not like the water security for human and ecological health that it so is essential for, we're not going to have a good future. And I think more and more people are realizing this, and I'm here to play a role in carrying this torch forward in a way that honors the truth and reconciliation of this land that needs to be talked about and worked through, our relationships with the land for the diverse communities that we call Canadian, which I would say are the first peoples of this land, descendants of settlers, and those new Canadians who are still arriving here today, and how can we bring them into that conversation.
Wonderful. Yeah, thank you so much, Colin. I want to say what Lauren Fitch said when we were down in Fort McLeod for the concert, which was, he said, if everybody here who is affected by the Eastern Slopes water, and people put up their hands and a few didn't, and he said, if you haven't put up your hand, put it up, because everybody in this room is impacted by this water, and this is how important this is. So let's start there. Let's outline what we've seen on the landscape, what our concerns are, how did we get here, kind of thing. So I'll lead off a little bit for you. So from my perspective, really respect the work that Brad Stelfox has done in terms of helping us understand how to measure the scale and impacts on the landscape. So to me, it is, we have roads that started us here, and then, like you guys already touched on, pipelines that have come in and impacted the way the water flows. We have oil and gas sites on the landscape that are also, Colin and I drove past oil and gas sites, we drove past gravel pits, we drove past, what else did we see, facility sites. And then of course, as Colin alluded to, the clear cuts. As we're driving, we can see all sorts of clear cuts through here. And then we can also talk about ranching. Ranching is a big footprint on the landscape as well. So we have this lifestyle that has been taking and taking and taking, and more focused on an energy, from my point of view, more focused on energy security, energy stability, energy growth, rather than water stability. So I think that's how we got here, and I would say this is, when I think about who's involved, this is governments, regulators, industry, and potentially complacent society, where this has just been ramping up to this now pivotal moment where we need to start really changing direction. So that's my point of view. I would love to hear your perspective, please.
Well, I think you've encapsulated a lot of it. In order to be prepared for this podcast, I took it upon myself to look at the South Saskatchewan Regional Plan, which is the policy, and I stress that it's a policy, that guides what happens on the eastern slopes here. And even though I knew it when I read it, it got to be more clear to me what this thing is about and how it is actually some very careful spin doctoring. Because right at the get-go, what it does is it outlines, A, that the government is concerned about the economy and the environment. The economy is first, always. There's no jobs on a dead planet. That's the overarching principle. And then they go on to express how the eastern slopes contain all these treasures. Oil and gas, coal mines, uranium, magnetite, limestone, rock quarries, and a lot of things that I can't even remember. The list is endless. And I'm thinking, so what's your point? If somebody wants to mine uranium now on the eastern slopes, we're going to go ahead and mine uranium. If somebody wants to mine magnetite, we're going to mine magnetite. If we want more oil and gas wells on a landscape that's already chock full of roads and industrial intrusions, we're going to do more of that. And then they have the audacity to say, well, we're not going to try and bring back things to a pre-contact level. Right. But they don't suggest at any point exactly what point they would like to maintain or even hold it at. They keep mentioning the cumulative effects and how we're going to manage the cumulative effects. At the same time, they're telling everybody, well, we're going to accommodate these other things. So this is the policy that's guiding the eastern slopes. And if you go out there, even if you only go do a Google trip up the eastern slopes, you will see what that policy is doing for us. You wouldn't be able to believe how much of our forest in this narrow little band of forest that Alan has correctly alluded to has disappeared. Sure, it's coming back with little tiny trees that in 150 years will be a viable forest again. In the meantime, actually, all of that new clear-cut forest doing is sucking up and aspirating more water into the air. So it's actually a net loss on the watershed. So that's kind of overall what we got. And then, of course, and everybody else is speaking about it so much that I don't feel I need to, the fact that our water will be, we don't have enough water to deal with the immense amount of use that coal mining has. But there's other aspects to this thing which I think are being somewhat overlooked, because I'm going to say, supposing they come up with some quack science that says, well, we can deal with the selenium. We figured out a way to deal with it. This is going to alleviate so much of the public concern about it that it may not even be a very big issue for people to realize that all up and down the entire eastern slopes, we're going to have a devastation of one of the most beautiful and iconic landscapes in all of Canada. Yes. Not to mention the 200 endangered species that are within the South Saskatchewan regional area. I mean, all this is going to do is escalate to a point where wildlife is not really a viable, viable thing. What it will be is last chance tourism will be the best thing that we got left. So my answer to that is, A, we got to call out these policies for what they are. There's nothing to stop any minister, land manager, or director from going against the policy because he decides to allow something to happen. We saw this firsthand on Corner Mountain, the bighorn sheep capital of the world. And, it's written right into the plans that this part of southern Alberta is the best place in North America for growing bighorn sheep. The world record came from here for years and years. And when Royal Dutch Shell wanted to drill wells on the top of Corner Mountain, a critical winter sheep range, all it took was a letter from the minister of the time to say, go ahead and do it, even though it's supposed to be a prime protection zone. These are big problems, and the only way we can deal with them is to get ourselves together and reject the idea that these land use plans are doing us anything and get solid legislation that says, thou shalt do this, not thou you may do this.
Right, yes. So I'm hearing we've got these laws that are not being upheld. We have ministerial orders that are overriding the laws, and the laws aren't being, nobody's being held accountable to them. Right.
Policies, not laws. The specific,
you
said that the SSRP is a policy, not legislation. So
that's
more easily overrided. But if they were laws.
Well, we've got to be careful on laws, because our fixed election date laws are a prime example. They can be changed pretty quickly if the government of the day decides they want to be changed. You would have to build a law that it was really hard to change. But it's absolutely critical. The government will claim that there's a whole lot of reasons for doing X, Y, or Z. Fact is, the Dominion Forester, back before there'd been a tree cut out here, except for the railways, recognized that, and I call it the sponge, that is the Eastern Slopes, was critical to the prairies. They put up a forest reserve. Mm-hmm. We protected it. We burned it down in the 30s. But when I started coming out here in the 60s, there were 5 trails. I mean, when you got to the end of the Old Man Campground, Old Man River Campground, that was the end of the road. Dad walked us 4 or 5 miles up that creek to fish, and we saw nobody after the first mile. Now, I'm going to run into 63 ATVs, RVs, dirt bikes, whatever. They're going to be running through the stream, destroying the integrity of the stream. They break down the banks. We need rules and regulations that are solid. They have to be enforced, and they have to be protected from the whim of the minister of the day.
Right. Yeah. The power that our government is using. I mean, let's be specific with the coal mines. Okay, so 76 policy was in place. Then we had Sonny Savage come in and say, nope, we don't care about this anymore. Then we had an uproar of people say, no, let's put it back in place. And then there was the coal committee that was formed, years spent trying to make sure that we had a plan to start changing. And yeah, you can speak to this. I'm just outlining the things. So that committee came out with some recommendations. Those were supposed to be actioned, and instead we had a new government come in place in 2023 that said, nope, we're going to revisit these coal mines again. And then through, in the middle of the coal hearing, which I know the Livingston Landowner Group had a big part in, our Minister of Energy circumvented that process and said, we're opening up the Eastern Slopes entirely again, and promising a policy for open or for closed pit mining in some miraculous form, but hasn't actually put it in legislation or law.
Consulting with industry in order to develop what it looks like.
Right, and then the industry, so I just need to add this because this just is the icing on the cake. So we have these potential lawsuits that our government seems to be egging on rather than defending. And one of the coal miners, Atrium, said that they can't use the technology that the minister is proposing in this legislation, and therefore this lawsuit is going ahead. They actually use that in their statement of claim, saying we cannot do this miraculous type of coal mining because it would be too expensive.
Well, that's basically what the government's been doing, is talking about magical thinking.
Right.
We have technology that will prevent selenium. The Mining Institute of Canada had Golders Associates, one of the best mining consulting companies in the world, review stuff. You can't clean up selenium.
Right.
And as Mike said, if we had a massive breakthrough, yes, you can capture all the water, you can suck all the selenium out of it, the stuff that comes out will be clean. We don't change the fact that you're changing hundreds and hundreds of square kilometers from a sponge to a rock pile. You mentioned Brad Stelfox. His work shows that if they opened up the proposed mines in this area, just in this area, not going up to the Clearwater or up to Grand Cache or any of those other places, there would be 6 billion tons of rock debris And I'm sorry, rock piles simply do not absorb, hold, and slowly release water. And even if they clean up the selenium, that doesn't mention all the other uglies that come out of leaching rock.
Right.
Selenium's the big one, but it's not the only one. And as I said, we screw it up, we can't put it back together again. This would be the Humpty Dumpty of all Humpty Dumpties if you wanted to try and put a mountain back together again after you dynamite it.
Yeah. Not gonna happen. Colin, do you have anything to add in terms of where we are, where we're coming from, your perspective?
I think a lot of good stuff has already been covered. I feel like there's something shifted in government lately. It's like governing behind closed doors, like, yeah, and like governing by mystical science in many ways. But I think there's also just like a cultural issue here of entitlement and like a modern prosperity. Like, as you said, in the 60s, the old man campground was like the end of the road. This two forces, the extractive forces of corporations just seeking to turn nature into profit, has the systems that allow that to happen have grown over time. Regulations have been suppressed or repealed, like the coal policy, but also, you know, during the pandemic, at the time was Spray Lake Sawmills lobbied the provincial government and miraculously got a 30% increase in the annual allowable cut, and then sold that business for millions of dollars to a multinational forestry company that basically has the license to log the entire eastern slopes for the next 20 years without any real enforcement. So that's just one part of the puzzle. That could be for oil and gas, for forestry, for coal mining. So regulations suppressed so that, you know, the environment doesn't have as much of a voice. And that's coupled with the cultural impact of more people living here, living very wealthy, prosperous lifestyles, being able to afford machines like ATVs, dirt bikes, and, you know, fancy recreational machines. It's not just walking up the creek from, yeah, you outline this very well. You go up the creek now there's 60 ATVs and all this stuff. So this wealth and entitlement of being able to use the landscape, maybe thinking back to when it was better, and with this shifting baseline syndrome, I think some people see it, but not everybody, that it's always been like this, and what damage am I causing by doing X, Y, and Z? And so, I think there's some sort of cultural shift that needs to happen, but I don't know how that happens. And it's constantly gonna be this fight against, you know, this individualism where I'm allowed to drive my ATV, or, you know, the corporation, or like West Fraser, is following the rules when they do that clear cut. Like, how bad can it be? But this is where I think we keep organizing the community, having guard, like encouraging a guardian and a stewardship type mindset that can be collectively woven together to build a story that's different than the one that I've grown up with, which is, you know, the mountains are amazing and they'll always be there for us. I'm just trusting that the regulations were going to take care of that, and I've learned that that's not the case.
Exactly. Well, thank you guys. You've outlined the problem quite well and touched a little bit on some solutions, but let's expand that thinking a little bit. So in terms of what needs to be done, let's outline some of that. So I really like the conversation I had with Kevin Van Tegem and Lauren Fitch last year around, you know, let's be specific. We're in the Beaver Mines, Castle River watershed.
Yeah.
And you've alluded to this. You have a group of people that have been protecting this area. So teach us, help us understand, what are the conversations? So what we discussed in that was a watershed needs to have adult conversations around what is on the landscape and what can go, what needs to stay. These are the ways I look at it in terms of actually getting the work done. I appreciate we have some holes in legislation, and you can certainly get into that, Mike. But first, can you outline for us what conversations are, what would that look like for us to come together and have these adult conversations about the harms that are on the landscape and what we do about them?
If I can throw one word in quickly, it's limits.
Yeah,
good word. Well, I've been posting a bit about what's happening in the Bob Marshall Wilderness area in Montana, which is a piece of the Rocky Mountain front that is almost identical in size to the area between Coleman and Kananaskis Country. 1 million acres of wilderness. that people every now and then from Montana post on their experiences in the Bob Marshall, and I go, oh God, if only we could have and do that. And I ask this question, well, why couldn't we have that?
Right.
Why does our landscape need to be run by multinational foreign corporations that are building roads, bulldozing, cutting down the trees, damming up the rivers, and destroying the wildlife? Why doesn't our government look after the public interest? And what the hell is the public interest? It's those benefits that all of us, and not the special interests and not the corporate interests. It's the air, it's the land, it's the wildlife, it's the water, it's the chance to get away to real wilderness and get away from all of the other problems that we have in society. We're losing that. In fact, I would say we've like 80% lost it on the eastern slopes here. If you go out there and look at, as you all alluded to, the kind of impacts, the over amount of use from everything, off-road vehicles, cattle, industrial activities, all of that has entirely shifted the focus away from having a land ethic that reveres our water and our land and our wildlife and our wilderness. And if there's anything that we need to do, we need to instill that sense back in the public somehow through this kind of thing, I presume, but also to have legislation that would protect the place for us. All of the groups nowadays are talking about protect the eastern slopes. I see it everywhere, protect the eastern slopes. But what are they talking about? And that's the question that I have, because I hear sort of, well, you know, let's protect the eastern slopes and stop the coal mines. There's nobody that wants to talk much about the logging. Definitely nobody that wants to talk about the cattle or the off-road vehicles or all of the other impacts that are happening out there. And I say this, we need to look at an example that's working. And there is one just south of the border. There's one that's working fine. There's a sustainable economy around it, and it provides benefit for millions of people. So my answer is we need to be aiming towards big wilderness protection for what we got left on the eastern slopes.
And you're right, why reinvent the wheel? Let's work from something that's already working and build it up. I know this is, Colin's been looking to BC a lot. We've heard about this. Montana has a plan for, they have a reforestation model in Montana from, am I saying that right?
We've been pointed that direction, pyramid logging, but we haven't made any connections there.
That brings about another point, and that is the vast amount of restoration work that we have to do on the eastern slopes. That means bringing back some species that have disappeared, like bison and beavers, and reforesting, getting rebedding the roads, getting rid of all the industrial roads, and somehow dealing with the massive amount of old gas wells and abandoned well sites and stuff that we have. I mean, there's work. There's a lot of work for people
it's
to do this.
It's a $260 billion economy is like the way I like to describe it. That's the amount of oil and gas sites on the landscape. And we do have the laws that we have polluter pay laws. You know, we have the means. We don't have the will. Go ahead.
You're kind of bringing me into a whole other area here, and that is almost all of my life, the Royal Dutch Shell Corporation has been drilling and inroading into the East Slopes here, all the way from Waterton to Caroline. They have three massive gas fields that they have now sold to a much smaller company, one that can nowhere near come up with the amount of collateral to deal with all of the vast reclamation work that needs to be done out there. And this is what the oil companies do. They produce until it's not that profitable anymore, sell them off to smaller, and then a smaller, and pretty soon at the end of the day, everything out there is bankrupt, and we, the taxpayers, are going to foot the bill for it. So we've got from just from this one corporation, we've got somewhere between 400 and 800 sour gas wells, three sulfur plants that have contaminated the groundwater around them for up to 4 kilometers with sulfate. And we have hundreds of miles of gravel roads where there should be no gravel roads that need to be dealt with. And the company that made that's worth $260 billion on the World Stock Exchange is going to walk away from here and not have to put a nickel in to deal with that. This is the same company that made $7 to $9 billion every quarter in Alberta here on these slopes. So, I mean, we've got a massive problem with the government and a regulatory body that does not look after us. They've been called, the AER is considered to be captive regulators for a good reason, because they never have ruled against any of these projects.
Right. And we're
That basically brings up the regulation is fine. Without enforcement, it's not regulation. If you can go out and do bad stuff and walk away from it somehow, no matter how well you finagle the legal stuff, it's not regulation. Mm-hmm. You absolutely have to enforce it. And that means at some point, someone like Royal Dutch gets their hands more than slapped. Like Teck in BC got fined $60 million. Sounds like a huge amount, but when you start translating that against their profits, did it stop them? No. Mm-hmm. If it doesn't stop them, it's not regulation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You just have to, again, going back to my earlier comment on limits. When I started out here, a decade or two after Mike first walked around this property, there were a million and a half people in Alberta. Mm-hmm. We're up at 5 million. And we've multiplied our technology and our ability to bang things up. When I came out here as a 10-year-old, I could have done almost anything short of lighting a fire, and I couldn't have hurt the countryside. Now, I can come out there with my brother, 6 friends, 4 ATVs, and we can tear the country apart. And we can bring our chainsaws and cut down a whole lot of trees to not create effective firewood. And then you magnify that by the ability of a faller brancher to clean out a hillside. You can't do it. Somebody has to sit down and realistically decide, this is how much use our countryside can take,
right. And
cut it back. You referred to Alcee's and the people who worked for them. They've got some very nice tools that say, if you get beyond so many miles of road, or so many kilometers per square kilometer, whichever terminology you want to use, you damage the habitat for X, Y, and Z.
Right.
That a stream crossing shouldn't be more than X, and you have to do it really carefully. Do we do any of that? Not on your life.
Yeah.
We need to determine as a society that this is how much we can do, and we can't do more. And that means a whole lot of people who have been saying, well, it's my right, are going to be told, no, it's your wrong.
Yeah. And I think to your point about limits, we are facing, we drove past how many rivers? 2-3 rivers on the way here?
Drove over many creeks and rivers, but the...
We did not get a lot of snow this year. Where to me this is, the rivers are low and that's normal for this time of year, but where's the snowpack to feed the rivers? We are potentially in a few ways meeting limits. So I'm listing one, which is a real water shortage that is potentially here this year for certain, like for the agriculture district for sure. The other is we're at a place where the world is not wanting energy export anymore. We're finally starting to see a tipping point in the global system where energy demand for fossil fuels at least is falling off. And I know that's probably a lot of people would argue this, but you know, I'm just going to point to what's happening in the United States right now with Trump placing these tariffs, dropping oil prices. Nobody's drilling into a $60 oil scenario. And, you know, India is moving towards renewables. They're talking about India and China being the biggest demand users. They've finally ramped up their renewable systems. So a big drop is expected, in my view. So there's lots of reasons to take limits seriously right now and realize that this is a pivotal moment for us to be adults and have those potential difficult conversations. Do you want to say more to that, Colin?
Yeah, maybe working on that limits theme, just think it makes me think of tipping points. And there's all sorts of negative tipping points, which I feel like we probably crossed or are very close to, but I also feel like there's social tipping points, and the scale of impact is undeniable, and you know, there's still many people that are unaware or don't think about that in their day-to-day, but there's a, thanks to the coal mining and the drought, like the natural limits that we're bumping up against, I think, and you know, you can think about the Calgary Bearspaw water main leak debacle this last year. I think all of these are contributing to a moment that we have a potential for a tipping point. Like, you know, it looks really bad with our current government not really doing anything environmentally positive. What's happening south of the border is unpredictable and creates a lot of, but I think it also creates a moment where we realize on the security side of things, like water security, economic security, they're all somewhat related. So there's been so much good work that's been happening, but I think we're now reaching a tipping point where all the different interest holders, water is becoming a central organizing issue that we can all agree on, or more people can agree on than say climate change or clear-cut logging specifically. But if we go to the fundamental layer of healthy water is key to a healthy future for anything, human health, but economy, all these things, I think we're at this moment where if we organize appropriately around that, we can bridge gaps between different interested parties, and I feel like we're nearing that. We're like, that potential is on the table for the year ahead, thanks to the coal mining issue, and there's been so much momentum and solidarity built, especially in southern Alberta around that. And yeah, just the ridiculous things that this government's doing is kind of exposing the corruption and the, are you serious? They can't be doing that. Mm-hmm. And this is what I hope will bring people together, and you know, relying on this people power and coalition building, that's where I'm trying to weave things together. And how do we think about it on a whole landscape scale? Like you've been talking to people up in the Clearwater County, they have very similar issues to the old man. They're different watersheds and different communities, but yeah, weaving these together. And then, yeah, there's Jenny alluded to that I've recently connected with the BC Watershed Security Coalition. And then over the 4 years of the pandemic, basically 2020 to now, they organized all their watersheds in partnership with local First Nations and did all the deliberating and came up with new policies, and then and collaborated with government. They had maybe a more friendly government than we do, but they've just unlocked $100 million for watershed security and restoration across BC. And
yeah, but 60 million of that is tech fine.
I think 50 million of it is from the BC Real Estate Foundation. The Real Estate Foundation acknowledged how important water security is to.
Anyway. Right, the value of homes?
Yeah.
What is your home worth if you have no water?
What's anything worth?
No kidding.
Exactly. I think that's where people, that conversation of like, if there's no water in the river, what, we can't survive here.
That's right. And it's a real equalizer, isn't it? Because suddenly all of these benefits, like you were describing about ATVs and the ability to go out there with six different families and make havoc. You know, are you going to want or care about any of those activities if you don't have water where you live? Okay, so let's get into the how, which is always the most difficult part of this conversation. But there's a couple things that have come up in here already, and so I appreciate that. But just to expand on that a bit, I want to touch on something that I've been working on with a group, the CARE Coalition. So it's a Coalition for Responsible Energy. And we are looking at the polluter pay principle and trying to make sure that the orphan fund, that is our safety net. That's the safety net that the industry promised us back in the 90s when they saw this problem mounting. This is what they were going to do. They were going to be there for us in the future. Now it's the future, so we need to get this orphan fund actually to a level where it's supposed to be. So So we're going to launch a campaign right away here to get the orphan fund adequately funded. So it means hearings, to Colin's point about the Cole hearing and how much it's brought people into awareness. We're going to take this forward and seek a hearing in the oil and gas side and hopefully get the same crowds out to understand how reckless the regulations, how they're not being upheld in that space especially. That's one thing. I think the other thing is about trying to get to this coalition building, this organization of like horizontal organizing, I'd like to describe it, and that's the work that Colin and I have been doing on the bioregional organizing sessions. So our, you know, this is where we're trying to build that awareness and knowledge around people that are just the average Albertan, as Brad has said, so that we have enough people pushing back and demanding this, like you were calling it, these local value systems, this that we need to remind ourselves we can't have it all. So that's a bit for me on where we go, but yeah, please expand, Mike, on how you see us moving forward now.
Well, I know what Timberwolf is doing, and that is we've joined forces with the Public Interest Law Clinic in Calgary, and our objective is to get comprehensive legislation developed before the next election so that we have something to hand the politicians and say, this is what we'd like to see on the Eastern Slopes, would you endorse this? And put their feet to the fire. And truthfully, one of the big ways that we got the castle protected is exactly that. It was timing more than anything, because we were out there protesting the logging in the castle at the same time as the election was coming up, and the New Democrats saw all this on television and so on, and Shannon Phillips, as a part of her campaign promise, said, well, if you elect me, I'll protect the castle. And she did. And, you know, it was a narrow window, but I see that same kind of window coming up for us again. And if we have a concrete plan for what we want to see on the Eastern Slopes, and from our point of view, it would be very much widespread wilderness protection that would eliminate a lot of the industrial and other activities that are happening there. And I know this is a tough sell because a lot of people are involved in those things, but they wouldn't have to disappear all at once. It could be a matter of grandfathering out some of them over a reasonable length of time. But at the end of the day, we would have something very real. We would have a protected watershed. We would quit losing species of wildlife, and we would still have a place where many, many people could enjoy the wilderness, not on machines, but by getting there and doing more traditional backcountry pursuits. So that's kind of where we're headed. I know that ultimately what's really required is public hearings, and that is something that this government has really gotten away from entirely. Now the only way you can comment on things like land use plans or something is they give you a coloring book with sort of very prescribed choices for you, so you don't ever really get to talk about or hear what the next guy thinks about it, or to realize that there's a broad consensus of people that just plain don't want this to happen out there. We don't see that. The government sees it, and they can tilt it any way they want to. I say, A, we need public hearings on what should happen with the Eastern Slope starting right away, and B, we need to be looking at and examples that are working. And I suggest that the ones that are truly working are the ones where they've designated big wilderness protection. That is not impossible. We can buy our way back out of a lot of these industrial intrusions that are happening there, and we're going to have to. But the government spends money on things that are detrimental to us. Big money on things that are detrimental. So why not on things that would ultimately have a very positive outcome? You know, just on the broader picture, years ago I read Jared Diamond's book, Collapse, and why some civilizations fail and why some succeed. And he listed five factors that have brought down all civilizations. And they are, as I remember them, climate change, deforestation, industrial degradation, loss of a trading partner. And this seemed ridiculous when I was reading it, that we would lose a trading partner. And ultimately war, because all of these things ultimately lead to war when the resources are so diminished and you got no way to trade for things you need, that leads to war. And I'm looking at our situation today and I'm saying, well, what part of this don't we have right now? And what's the ultimate outcome of it going to be for us unless we change this, turn this ship around? From my point of view, unless we can really pull together all of the factions that have the good intent for getting a land ethic and for looking after what we got left here, we could easily be headed down that other road.
Yes, and this is where alternatives really help us understand where we want to go rather than what's ahead of us. Thank you so much for outlining those things. My goodness. Yes, you're right. It's so hard to believe that we've lost the... We're in war with the United States right now. Yes, it's an economic war, but it's war. Yeah. And we need to recognize it as that and understand, like you said, if we don't act where we're headed, it's the evidence is there 200 years in our history at least. Please,
to,
Alan.
To pick up on some of the stuff you said, Mike, the man limit, the number of people let in. You have to apply for a permit. You can only launch at a certain point. You must camp at certain places. Completely carry in, carry out.
Right.
You don't get to leave your poop in the woods.
Right.
You don't get to share the latrine with the bears.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a wonderful experience.
Right.
But if you're not really lucky, you don't get to do it. And that seems to be anathema to Alberta. You can have a bad experience and everybody can have it, or you can have a good experience and only a few of you get it.
Right.
And Alberta has been opting for bad experience all the time.
Mm-hmm.
They don't appear to recognize that you can sell a picture of a tree a few million times, you can sell a 2x4 once.
Mm-hmm.
They're into monoculture reforestation.
Right.
They haven't apparently even read Suzanne Simard's book about how forests maybe really work, not mow it, plant it with the same stuff, kill everything else, and hope.
Mm-hmm.
We know that most forests are multi-species,
right.
And we know that most of them are multi-age, and all of that stuff. And yes, occasionally bad shit happens. Things catch fire and they burn down towns like Jasper. But that's also a reflection mostly of the fact we spent 100 years being stupid.
Right. 100%.
And if we hadn't spent 100 years being stupid, we wouldn't have burned Jasper.
Mm-hmm.
We have to look at limits. But on the environmental side, the anti-government side, the anti-business side, whatever you want to call us, you and I have both been called eco-terrorists, I think, by the people I'd like to call eco-vandals.
Mm-hmm.
There's a whole lot of people out there, but we're in little groups. And little doesn't work when you're up against a giant.
No.
Despite the David and Goliath stories, Goliath damn near always wins.
Mm-hmm.
So we've got to find a way to become larger, more effective, and that's going to take some of the local out of it. But I'd rather win with a giant something than lose with a whole bunch of virtuous little guys.
Right.
Like Mike and I can probably name a dozen groups in Southwest Alberta that are involved. None of them are big enough to fight Gina Rowland or Gina Reinhardt. None of us are big enough to fight Shell. But if we could get AWA and CPAWS and Timberwolf, and Livingston Landowners, and Pekisko, and Chinook Headwaters, and the list goes on, into a cohesive group, we might actually be able to attack things.
Mm-hmm.
I know what a good environmental lawyer costs. Well, I can't finance him for very long, but 10 or 12 of us could finance him for longer. And 1,000 of us could probably finance them into a good fight.
Right. Yeah.
We've got to start being strategic, and we have to figure out who we need to target on the other side. We go out and talk to crowds, and you've referred to this, they're mostly silver-haired. Part of that is age, but part of that is also interest and time. I mean, I didn't have time to do this when I was working. But we can do it if we target, and we need to figure out how we get to the people on the government side to make them stop.
Right.
We got them to stop the first time around because we got a whole bunch of conservative supporters telling their MLA, back off, buddy. And if we can do that, we can stop them. If all we do is preach to the converted, it isn't going to work.
Yes. And this is where we have to have these difficult conversations, right? Yeah. We can't, like you said, sit where it's comfortable and think that we're making progress. And thank you for bringing in, I know you both have hearings and lawsuits, because at the end of the day, Mark Doran, who I work quite closely with on this Polluter Pay Federation and this CARE campaign I was just describing, has said, our laws need to be enforced in the courts. That's the only way you can uphold the polluter pay principle is through the courts.
And we have to have enough inspectors who can't be captured, as Mike said. And then we have to have the prosecutors who have the backing to go and take the big guys to court and not just slap them on the wrist with a $150,000 fine for a $10 billion company. They have to be shut down.
Yeah.
My wife and I go out into the eastern plains quite often, and the area where we go has a ton of orphan wells. And we've watched the well sit there for 5 years with no appreciable change.
Yeah.
There's a sign that says orphan well. There's a pump jack without a head. There's a bunch of piping disconnected and lying around the ground, and it hasn't changed in 5 years.
Yeah.
Now, somebody somewhere in the Alberta oil patch has responsibility for that.
Absolutely.
But they managed to hide behind a bunch of layers of legal fiction. They took their money and ran and left us with a mess.
And Alberta, I was just talking about this, is one of the only, Alberta, BC, and Saskatchewan have a history of every single site. There's many states and provinces like Ontario that there are some sites that people don't even know exist. In Alberta, we can trace every single site back to the original one. So we have the ability to do lookbacks. I know that's one thing that has been made very clear by some of the bigger players, because they are a high percentage of the orphan problem, is to do adequate lookbacks. And there is a pathway to individuals even. We had Sue Rydell Rose, who was a part of the Sequoia Perpetual dumping of liability. She personally settled for liability. Now, it was 10 cents on the dollar, but regardless, there is precedent. That is precedent-setting legislation. Same thing with Shell and Paraday, I think you were alluding to. That is not legally in their name, it's still in Shell's name on license.
Yeah, well, we've been fighting that license transfer for quite a while, and
right.
I'm afraid ultimately we will lose, but we need to get a lot more people interested in that.
That's right.
I mean, let's not let them transfer that license.
If you could track back through all the companies to the Murray Edwards of the world.
That's right. And well, and more so the Shells, the ExxonMobil's. Because like CNRL has been the dumping ground. I had a friend at ATB say to me, you know, this is the alternative to the orphan problem. CNRL is the solution to the orphan problem, because they're taking all the liability on, all this idle liability sitting on the landscape is a lot in CNRL's hands, right? Through the Devon acquisitions, through the...
Everybody.
Yeah, just cobble it together.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned Devon, because there's something that's gnawing at me, and that is Plateau Mountain, which is, by any standards, one of the most iconic mountains in all of Alberta, because it is a tundra mountain that was above the last ice age and still has permafrost under it. And at some point in our history, the government allowed the oil companies, and I don't know which one it was, to go up there and bulldoze a road the entire length of that mountain. and drill wells. I don't know how many, I can't remember now, but there's several wells up there that are now in this state of unknown, because all of those wells fed the Devon field, right, the plant at Coleman. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole series of them all the way down the valley. To me, it is like the ultimate sticking a thumb in your eye as far as caring about our environment and the special place that we have here on the Eastern Slopes. It's a fantastic place. It is still it has all the same characteristics of the high Arctic and the same plants. It has ptarmigan and there's bighorn sheep up there and there's ice caves that are famous. And the idea that it wouldn't even be considered a place that's sort of a beyond reproach to allow, you know, we need oil, we need money, let's go up there and get it. The fact is that the big oil did not have to do an environmental impact. They were relieved of having to do any environmental impacts on any of their operations. So we fought them here and lost because of the regulators, but they drilled wells in places where we knew we had rare and endangered plants. We had limber pines, was grizzly bear habitat, all of that, and we lost. And what it really means is that at the end of the day, we have a government that does not give a damn, really, about the intrinsic values of the Eastern Slopes.
And I think Sid Marty wrote about it. Well, Plateau Mountain stuff.
He may have done. I don't know.
It's in one of his books. I remember him writing about trying to get a protest going, and he showed up, and there were two people.
Well, I was one of them, and that was on Cordon Mountain.
I think
maybe it was leaning on the wind.
Yeah. I mean, we need a change of government, for one thing, and we need to make sure that when we change the government, that we are able to tell them the kind of rules that we'd like to see on the Eastern Slopes. Instead of the government going into power and right away having a whole slate of corporations that come to them and say, well, we contributed to your campaign, we'd like to do this and we'd like to do that out there.
100%. Colin, do you want to round it out for us? What did you hear in terms of how are we moving?
Well, I just really I appreciate this conversation, but keep coming back to this. The time is now, but the window is like 2.5 years. Looking towards new government, that we have to build this, how did you say it, bring together the factions, and I wrote down a coalition for a new land ethic. I think this coalition building is the key. You talked about all these diverse groups that we're all doing our own little thing, but how do we become bigger? I don't exactly know that, but the hearings, the public, hosting public town, if the government's not going to do it, somebody has to. And you basically said we need to start doing that now, and I agree. Coalition building is difficult also. You can't go too fast or else you lose some people. You can't go too slow or else you also lose some people.
And you lose your window.
Yes, right. Lose the window. And so I see two windows. One is the municipal election on October 20th of this year, where every town, city, county, MD will be electing new governments. So that's basically 6 months from now, roughly. What can the different groups, the nonprofits, the NGOs, the landowner groups, individual community leaders, how can we come together and organize around that municipal election, which then, if we do that well, sets the stage for continued organizing. And I've had this vision of like a declaration for, we could call it Eastern Slopes Headwater Protection, a declaration on water security, whatever. I don't want to be prescriptive because I think this has to come from the group. I see these windows of time lining up well. I hate to say it, but drought of this summer is it's going to be a topical issue that we can organize around. And yeah, it was another thing I've learned from BC is they paid for polling. So you mentioned paying for lawyers, which I think is a part of the plan, but they paid for public opinion and polling on water.
LLG did pay for a poll this fall, this spring.
Yes. Okay.
Poll,
so
right?
There's press. Yeah. And so we can continue to do that.
Thank you, by the way.
but bring our dollars together, as you also alluded to. Mm-hmm. But yeah, it's hard because there's difficult conversations that come up when, you know, certain groups have certain interests and other groups have different interests and they clash sometimes, but I think we can all agree on clean water. So I'm hoping.
Actually, at the rural municipalities, Cam Gardner from Ranchland presented a motion saying we want clean water. 53% said yes.
Wow, only 53%?
Who are these 47%?
Stupid.
Yes.
Well, maybe there are sources of pollution that feel threatened by, if I say I want that, then I'm going to have to change. And that's a thing that's going to have to happen. We need people, we need businesses, we need things on the land to change. And those are where the hard conversations are going to have to happen. Like, there's a niche faction of people that will be very upset that we're saying, we're organizing around you not being allowed to drive your ATV through a creek anymore.
No more new development. Like, yeah. If we stopped there, it would be, I could sleep better at night, you know? If we were at least saying no more new fossil fuel extraction.
Yeah.
If we just limited to what we have and produce it down, it would be a massive win to get us at least focused on the restoration. Like you said, we have a tremendous job to do. And if you talk about this declaration, sorry, I'm gonna tee it back to you. One of the things that I was overwhelmed with by this $260 billion problem is where do we start? And to me, what Kevin and you guys have all given me is the Eastern Slopes. This is our taps, if you will, our water source.
Yeah.
So and if we focus...
Don't forget that if you go back to the 70s, there are two gigantic water diversion things that came out, both sending water to the States. One of them basically involved damming the Rocky Mountain Trench and turning it into a giant lake from Site C down to the Libby Dam in Montana. And there was one on the Alberta side with dams starting on the Athabasca with siphons and pipelines shifting it down into the Milk River.
Yeah. Wow.
Those are still out there. Trump's been talking about that giant faucet in Canada.
Right, exactly.
And you will notice that the irrigators who are largely conservatives are not chipping in on this idea that selenium is a problem. And I believe the reason that they're not getting involved is because they've already had the discussions about water transfer that can happen by damming doing this connective damming business. And the government is even talking about it. It's in the literature that they're thinking about that as the solutions. Yeah, we'll mine the eastern slopes and we'll transfer the water from the Athabasca down here.
So insane.
You have to be as old as you and me, Mike, though, to remember it.
Yeah, that's probably right.
I think this is where these hearings, they're not all about hearings, there's some education that needs to be, like, we talked about educating, like, bringing awareness to the oil and gas infrastructure in the area. But also, like, I've heard these as rumors, and I've always said, no way. But you're telling me these transfers from the Athabasca to the Milk Watershed is after there's like a
the Prime,
plan
isn't
somewhere.
It called the Prime plan?
I can't remember
like
the name on it.
There's a name for
these
it.
Are alarming plans that if more people are aware, I think it galvanizes people towards saying, I'm going to stand up and say no to that. And I think that's what's happened with the selenium issue. But there's all these other issues that are talked about behind closed doors that the general public are not aware of. I am heading in the direction of doing what my humble person can do to help organize these kind of town halls and different watersheds and bringing together these stakeholders. But I do want to say that my first focus or my intention is I think we need to be standing in solidarity as a certain demographic of this land, but standing in solidarity with First Nations treaty rights and sovereignty. I think we will get further or we'll be more successful if we're standing shoulder to shoulder with First Nations. But those relationships take time to build, and there's decolonization of our thought processes that have to happen. And yeah, so I'm trying to be intentional of not rushing into this coalition thinking I have it all figured out, but over the next couple weeks and months, prioritizing connecting with First Nations on this topic.
Just on the topic of hearings, would it be possible to replicate what the Lougheed government did?
Which is?
Yeah, can you tell us more?
Well, East Slope hearings.
Eastern Slope hearings.
There was about 2 years of hearings all over the province.
Leading right up to the new
on what you want, and then leading into a report. Now, it would be hard to do. It would be expensive even if the commissioners were not paid.
Because the government paid for it when Lougheed did it. We are basically doing it from the grassroots up.
But if you can get reputable people, that's the problem. Because the opposition is going to say almost anybody that we chose is biased, and we know what it's going to say, and it's going to be, how do you find...
What did Warren get called?
Eco-terrorist.
But he was also called activist.
Yeah.
So now we just ignore people with 50 years experience, and this issue is now just labeled an activist.
Anyway, big problems, but if you can replicate that, and you, if we're talking 2 years, you could publish the report immediately before election. Because we know when the election's supposed to be.
With policy recommendations.
If you could replicate those and have people like Brad Stelfox and Warren Fitch and a host of other people, could you get Stadnick out of U of C, who's been on the news all this time saying, we're short of water. John Pomeroy saying,
no kidding,
it ain't going to come the way it used to. You're going to have to do a whole lot of things if you want water out there.
Mm-hmm.
The first thing is, quit screwing up the collection.
Yeah.
If you could do that, it could be a very powerful tool.
I love it.
I understand that there were a bunch of ridings in Calgary that went conservative by only a few hundred votes.
Correct.
And if you only need to swing 500 votes out of tens of thousands, you don't need a very powerful push.
No.
They say the law, there's a rule in organizing, they say if you can get 3.5% of the population or group or the total population involved in a specific issue, you change it. So it's
not much for a movement.
Yeah, and there's that bit about big changes that have ever happened have been because a few people wouldn't quit.
That's right. And I think what's really come to light from this, and you know, this is the, my son said this to me when I left, well, when I was, I would say, pushed out of industry in 2022. They cut your head off and instead you grew 10 heads, right? So
Hydra,
that's exactly what he said. And it's true. So I think that's, to me, it's like you were saying, having conversations with folks like you that have been battling this in an isolated area, small population in Alberta. The more we can amplify your message, your knowledge, your history, your efforts, the more we can come together and build some real things. And I also think of the Lord of the Rings line where it's low chance of success, highly unlikely, I'm in. Right? I know that's not the right, but you get the idea. Any closing thoughts from anyone before we wrap? Yes,
I think we need to talk again. I'd like to chip in a little on this idea. I think East Slope hearings are a must. If not, not just likely, but a must. But
they have to be carefully structured. They can't be...
Yeah.
Timberwolf did one in Beaver Pines.
You know what we almost need prior to that is a task force.
That's what I'm thinking.
To go up the eastern slopes from Waterton to as far as we want to protect it and just do an inventory of everything that's going on there and what the downside of that is. It's simple. You just go up, there's several thousand miles of roads, and this is the downside for fish, this is the downside for bears, so on. And, that could be accomplished in a matter of a year.
Elsie's probably has most of that.
They might, but I kind of think that we need some new media. We need a brand new task force that's kind of multidisciplinary.
Citizen, community-led, with experts, but it's like,
Yes, well, and a variety of, not just biologists, not just foresters, but a combination of a whole suite of people that understand all of it.
Kind of like the task force should have, somebody, a representative from kind of each, like, fishing and... And I want to be clear, I don't think industry and government should be involved.
Absolutely not. Yeah. This is our downfall. I mean, they're at the table, at all the land use tables. Who's at the table? Shell and West Fraser.
That's a consensus-based process. I think we talked about this. The consensus-based, multi-stakeholder just leads the environmental demands.
It comes down to conflict of interest. Yeah. Like, the people that have a conflict of interest don't decide the rules on what's happening. That's one thing. I think our biggest downfall is talking in the local communities that have a conflict of interest in this thing.
Yes.
There are very many special interest holders that live close to the eastern slopes that have special interests they want to preserve.
Well, we saw that at the Pincher hearing.
You would, for sure. And First Nations have not been involved in the discussion at all. And B, the big amount of the populations have not been really involved in the discussion. And when anybody does any kind of polling, in the big cities about what they want to see for the eastern slopes, the answer is really clear. They want to protect it and save it, you know. And you're not going to get that same thing from all of these communities that vote Tory every time because there's a reciprocal trade-off. They get a benefit. They get grazing for like $4 a animal unit, or they get free, you know, virtually no stumpage for timber, so on.
And there's also a blindness. Pincher had a community meeting about the healthcare problems when they were down to like 3 or 4 docks. And there were probably more than 1,000 people there. And person after person got up and said, why? And I resisted the temptation to get up and say, because of you folks. According to the numbers, 3/4 of you voted for the people who are giving you this bad health care.
That's right.
You have to change who you're sending to Edmonton.
That's right. Yeah. I mean, we talk about our government letting industry off the hook. We're letting industry off the hook when we vote in these governments that only answer to industry and not public interest. Sorry, I'm going off.
No. Which would take us to how the hell do you make elections actually fair?
Well, and this is another thing that might come out of this.
Yeah, we're not doing that today.
Yeah. But this, okay, when we talk about getting these elected officials that stand behind these mandates that we're trying to build over the next couple of years, those elected officials should be people from the community that is representing that community. So that's another tie that we could have into this, is to think about how do we stand up local people that have to look their neighbors in the eyes and understand, make these tough decisions. And again, I think that might come with the limits that we're also facing too, right? It's going to be harder to skirt.
Well, this it makes me think about the pledge that the BC Watershed Security had. They had a list of all of the provincial candidates from all parties. It was just a list of all the candidates leading up to an election. And they had a watershed security pledge, quite simple, but like, as a potential elected official.
We're in favor of clean water?
Exactly, basically. And they were, you could see which candidates had signed the pledge. And if they hadn't signed the pledge, you could click a button that opened up an email and said, hey, so-and-so candidate, would you sign this pledge for clean water? And they got over 50% of the candidates to sign on to that pledge. And they did that in conjunction with like media coverage, as well as the polling they hired, or to survey a demographic or like all of the BC population, and they got confidence that water security is a huge issue for the general population, and it kind of gets past our current government's poor engagements where they're all behind closed doors, you don't know if there's a consensus. But if we do the polling and we see 80% of Southern Alberta wants clean water, we can push ahead with certain activities that demand more things and encourage and tell politicians, this is what the polling says, you should probably sign this pledge.
Thinking strategically, you'd have to convince a bunch of people in places like Oyen that the mountains really matter.
Mm. Right.
Hannah might be easier because they suck their water out of the Red Deer River now.
Yeah.
Right.
But they will remember when they were reliant on dugouts that
never felt up. Yeah. It's the desert out there.
Towards the end of the 80s, the dugouts were getting awfully low before the power plant came in, which incidentally I helped do the EIA on. Mm-hmm. My father-in-law drilled most of these wells.
Amazing. Yeah.
Mike was speaking to earlier before we started talking how we all have played a role in something in the past that we might
regret. Yeah. Yes, 100%.
Sorry.
Are there people who know enough about how to do a campaign? Because most of those small town papers, if you send them stuff, we'll be more than happy to print it. So if you do 6 months worth of water is important, and then you say, you may not know it, but your water actually comes from, and you change the message depending on where.
Out
of the Red Deer River, the headwaters, they're planning to put a coal mine up there, which will pollute your water, reduce the amount. Tell your MLA.
Yeah. I think I just want to go back to something you said that's so important, Mike. I think we need this cross-pollination effort in terms of we have vested interest in certain areas and those decisions are held to those certain individuals and we need those pressures from outside. And I would say that's true, you know, from every aspect. You know, we have healthcare workers that aren't allowed to stand up against the way the healthcare system is being run. Same thing with education. So if we had, you know, healthcare workers fighting for education and education fighting for healthcare, these are the ways I think we can really start pushing these messages from different voices in a similar approach that's happening from the top down. I say that we need to have another one of these, so let's plan for that. Thank you so much for your time, guys. This has been incredible. I really appreciate it. And yeah, of course, any final words, happy to give you some space for that before you head.
I think I said too much already.
No, it's been fantastic.
Are we going for lunch after this? Can we continue the conversation?
Absolutely, yes, please. Mm-hmm.